Welcome to the third episode of the Little House Book Club. The Little House Book Club is family-friendly and listener-supported, which means no commercials. Today, we finish our discussion with the book Little House in the Big Woods, published in 1932 by Laura Ingalls Wilder, of course. Just like last time, I have Annie Quinn. How are you doing, Annie?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. We have J.J. Hurley. How are you doing, J.J.?
Great, thank you.
And we have Stephanie Bailey. Come on down. So, I just want to dedicate this particular episode to all of the whales and calves who lost their lives for fashion and cheese, because that's where a lot of my research ended up, is reading all about whale bones, the price of whale bones, and the poor calves whose stomachs, one stomach, the fourth stomachs, were sliced in pieces to make cheese.
Yeah.
But moving on, where did we leave off last time? We stopped after chapter 6, and here we are going to begin on chapter 7, the sugar snow. I don't know if we want to do a round table type of thing where I can give an overview of the chapter, or if one of you do, it's totally fine.
You do it, Mark.
Okay.
You do it so well.
I don't know about that, but how dare you. So I just want to also emphasize that this half of the book really, it continues to focus on the relationship of women and work. I think that's very important to look at these books, is the way women did approach not only their work, but also their place in family and in the work. Their homes were, I think everybody could agree, were kind of like factories. They made butter and cheese, sugar, clothing, candles, soap. The men went and they would hunt for the food and, you know, the fur, and they would get the furs from the animals. But everyone had their roles. Even the kids had their roles. Where the Ingalls were raising their family, there was a Native American tribe called the Anishinaabeg. Anishinaabeg. This is a role, the way that the structure, the family structure of the children having the chores and the mother doing all of these really remarkable list of things that they would have to do, and the husband out there hunting and playing the fiddle, you know, I guess entertaining. You know, it's really interesting because they had the same exact kind of dynamic. There are a lot of correlations between the Anishinaabeg and white people at the time. Ooh, it's pouring rain. I don't know if you guys could hear that. makes me feel like I'm in the little house and upstairs with all the cheese and sitting on a pumpkin. So the settlers, Laura looking out the window, and she sees a patch of snow-free ground. She asks her mom if she can go outside, but Ma says that Laura has to wait until tomorrow. Laura wakes up the next morning, and she's cold. She's told to snuggle with Mary, and she notices that fresh snow has fallen. So we're getting those days where it's like a little bit warm, and the next day it's freezing. You know, I think maybe some of us are even going through that now.
It's like Texas.
Yeah, right. Literally, right? So Pa tells her that it's called a sugar snow. He explains that Grandpa gets sap from trees because when it snows, it delays the leaves from growing. So it takes a longer amount of time for the sap to flow through the trees to the leaves. And we learn that they're going to be going to Grandpa's for something called a sugar off. In advance. Well, a sugar off is essentially, and this also comes from the Anishinaabeg. They had an entire month of sugar off, and they would essentially collect the sap from the trees, get together, and they would cook it. You know, they would, have any of you ever made maple syrup from trees?
No.
No. No. Never lived near a maple tree.
Yeah, you can make it from a number of different trees. I've never had the opportunity to do it. A friend of mine has done it, and she talks about the entire process. It really seems kind of messy and sticky and very time-consuming. I'll put a link to, you know, all about, you know, how to make it if people did have an interest in doing it. It's a pretty crazy. They refer to the sap as the blood of the tree, which it really kind of is. When Pa's discussing the process of making the maple syrup, he describes, so essentially the sugar off is essentially a party where everybody gets together and they boil down the sugar to make it thick, and are also going to process the sugar. I guess that's the best way to describe what a sugar off is. And there's also going
Sounded
to be a
like
dance.
Like a fun day. Yeah, yeah. The dance is fun.
Now, what's interesting is that we hear a lot about how it's grandpa who's doing the processing, right? I think that's even described as he's the guy, you know? But when it really comes down to it, like when we're at the party, it's really grandma who's doing it. Did you guys notice that?
Oh, yeah. She's in there the whole time. She said that we're stirring to the beat of the music or something. I think that's one of the lines.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, because you know what it is? I think she's just like, I want to get out there and dance. And we get to a really fun scene coming up pretty soon. But when Ma learns that there's going to be a dance, she says, oh, Charles.
Oh, Charles.
It's sweet. No, she
used to wear her dress.
Her Delaine.
Yeah, her Delaine. Now, when Pa said that there was going to be a party, I noticed that she was mending. And, of course, Wednesday is unmend day. It must have been that day. I don't know. I just started kind of like, oh, well, you know, now I'm starting to kind of feel the week of the angles.
Right.
But do you guys want to talk about Ma's Delaine dress? What a Delaine is.
I looked up a little bit. I don't know how much you guys did, but I think it actually comes from, it's like French in origin. And it just kind of literally means of wool. Mm. So it's literally like mostly 100% wool dress.
Sounds warm.
Yeah.
And itchy.
And she bought it from a store. So it's store made or store bought. And very detailed of, I don't have the notes right in front of me, but it just sounds gorgeous, honestly.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically it was dark green and it had a little pattern all over it that looked like ripe strawberries. So, you know, it was a really decorative type of dress. We also get this weird line, Ma had been very fashionable before marrying Pa.
Yeah, I have that highlighted myself. You know, I guess the fashions have changed when you live in the big woods. But I didn't realize that before she married Pa, it said a dressmaker had made her clothes, because we only know her as making all the clothes for the family. And so I thought that was just interesting. I didn't know that about Ma, that she used to have store-bought clothes.
Store-bought?
Like she came from money or something.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think she does. And I think that, you know, as we go on, we'll discuss more about that, I think. But one of the things I thought was interesting is they were talking about the way the dress is made, and they bring up the whale bones, and the whale bones are basically used to the, what would you call
shape.
It? The shape of the dress itself. It was like that big round kind of hoop look. And whale bones were used because they were so strong, light, and flexible. I just thought that was kind of interesting. Another thing that we notice, well, we don't notice this, but when you're reading that passage that she had bought fancy dresses and everything, people seem to think that maybe that might have been New York City or Boston. But really, Ma's East was really far west. It was probably more eastern Wisconsin or on the shore of Lake Michigan. Just, you know, I'm not trying to take anything away from her.
She used to be fashionable.
Yes. That sounds like a Harriet Olsen line.
Exactly. It does. Absolutely.
Caroline was once a very fashionable woman. I started looking at the price of whalebone. This is kind of crazy. The price of whalebone went really up. In 1870, it was $687 per ton of whalebone. That's about $14,000 actually. And by 1902, it had risen to $4,100 per ton. So in comparison, that's a 4x jump, really. Well, even more, because that's worth about $60,000 in today's money. So at its height, it was worth roughly $60,000 in today's money. It was worth more than whale oil. So I just thought that was kind of, you know, the things, the animals that were killed and slaughtered for the sake of fashion. Very crazy. And it would come in and out of fashion. People would use wood also, but it was a lot heavier. The whalebone was very, very lightweight and very strong. So, but Ma had to have the best, I guess.
Well, and I thought it was so, like, you could tell how Laura just got so excited then, because they knew that if Ma was going to get out the Delaine, that this had to be something extra special, you know. So I can imagine if this is on a Wednesday and they don't go until the next Monday, I think it said, that I can imagine, like, Laura just being, you know, extra buoyant.
Yeah,
and I think and excited and all of the above because this is their first dance. Yeah,
it's also exciting because you know they're going to see their cousins and our aunts and our uncles. So you know this is a big deal. You know, everybody here gets excited when there's a dance coming up, but for them it was so much of a bigger event, I guess. And we get a song from Pa, the I'm Captain Jinx of the Horse Marines. I have a link to the original lyrics. It's weird. In the book, definitely Charles rewrites all these songs. Lauriel Wilder rewrites all of Pa's songs to be so much more kid-friendly than they are. So if you go into them, it's kind of, there's always this little darkness to them, or they're kind of risque. For all the songs that are sung or played, I kind of found somebody doing it. Or if I found maybe a copy of a 78 from the 30s. But on to chapter 8, Dance at Grandpa's. The Ingalls get up early and they head through the great big woods to Grandpa's. The men haul the maple syrup to Grandma, where she pours it in a kettle to grain. Grain is a process that, you know, when you cook it, it gets to a point where they put it in, I think, snow. Did you guys look into this at all? I couldn't really, as somebody who's never made maple syrup, I kind of was really confused at the whole process of it.
It sounded like they were making, like, candy almost.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like, no, when you make caramel and it grains up, it gets all gritty.
I was thinking that the grain means that it's crystallizing into, like, table sugar, almost. But I'm not sure.
That's what it sounded like to me.
Like if you leave maple syrup for too long, or not for really too long, but if you have maple syrup that's maybe 8 years old like we do probably because we don't really use maple syrup, and you look at it and it's like on the bottom, it's all crystallized. I did learn that it's totally fine to still use. Maple syrup is a lot like honey. It doesn't spoil very easily. I noticed that there were a lot of inconsistencies with the writing. I don't know if you guys have looked into the history. This book took about 20 years to write and rewrite, and that was with Rose Wilder's input and just going back and forth. And I find that there are some passages that I just personally don't believe were written by the same people.
I don't think you're the only one. I think that's you know, part of the lore out there.
Yeah, it's just, I'm starting to find sections. I'm starting to, like for instance, this is an example of what I feel as though either Rose Wilder wrote or Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote. After a while, there was sunshine in the woods and the air sparkled. The long streaks of yellow light lay between the shadows of the trunk trees, or the tree trunks, and the snow was colored faintly pink. All the shadows were thin and blue, and every little curve of snowdrifts and every little track in the snow had a shadow. Pa showed Laura the tracks of the wild creatures in the snow at the sides of the road. The small leaping tracks of cotton-tail rabbits, the tiny tracks of field mice, and the feather-stitching tracks of snowbirds. There were larger tracks, like dog tracks, where foxes had run, and there were tracks of a deer that had bounded away into the woods. I just feel like it's so constructed.
It's so visual.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost overly visual. It's like, you know what? We gotta describe this. It's almost like your editor sat you down and said, look, you just got to get into some descriptions. Talk about the colors of things. Talk about the animals. Talk about the tracks. And then they just took it to heart. But I don't know. As I'm reading it, I originally started reading the book. Well, when I first went through the entire book, I read it from the point of view of a 5-year-old. Now I'm reading it as though it's a 60-year-old who has to rewrite from the eyes of a 5-year-old.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I did a lot of research about how to make maple syrup. I didn't learn very much. It's not something I think I would want to personally do. I don't like maple syrup very much. It looks fascinating. It looks like a lot of fun if it's something you really want to get into. We also learn about hot hasty pudding, which I have a recipe for, which is essentially a cornmeal that they all had for dinner. They all had hot hasty pudding, which it was almost like a meal, like a simple meal, and they put a little bit of maple syrup in the middle.
I love that paragraph, how they pointed out that the men had taken their dinners you know, to the woods. So for dinner, they had nuts at the table, but for supper. And I love that use of, instead of, you know, lunch and dinner, it's dinner and supper.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to start trying to bring back dinner and supper in my house and see how that goes over.
Yeah, you know, it would be
nice.
See
what confusion it brings. Supper just has a nice warm, like, it just makes you feel like, oh, supper. I don't know. Dinner seems more formal than supper.
Or right, it's like a supper time or dinner time, you know. It does. It seems nice.
Yes.
There are a lot of things in here. We also all might have an Uncle George, a wild Uncle George.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of a deep dive on Uncle George. Now, although Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote that Uncle George had run away to be a drummer boy in the army when he was 14, there's no evidence of this. There is a George Wilder who is enlisted, but his age doesn't make any sense. It's a different George Ingalls. Sorry, I said Wilder. Sorry. But yeah, there's no George Ingalls. There's no record of... I'm getting all my names kind of screwy here for a second. So there's James and there's Hiram. Hiram is the other brother. It's my theory that it's Hiram who's the uncle who's wild. Hiram was a bit older. He actually was away in the war. And there's a lot of weirdness. He played the bugle, but he was a drummer boy. There's no explanation as to why he'd be wearing his Union Army uniform. That doesn't really make too much sense. And why would somebody who's a wild 14-year-old kid, you know, pretty crazy, who runs off to be a drummer boy, why is he sitting there, you know, making maple syrup with everyone? It just doesn't seem consistent to me with the kind of person that Uncle George might have been if he is wild. I'm not really sure what's going on there, but I have a feeling that it goes elsewhere. And I'm sorry. Go on.
Sorry. Maybe it's like a culmination of a few people like she did with Nellie Olson later.
Right.
It's definitely possible. She doesn't mention her Uncle Hiram at all in the books. On the note of George Ingalls, not to totally point my finger at all of them, George had kind of a very turbulent and tragic life and a tragic marriage and all of this. At the time of his marriage, George Ingalls was a farmer living in Rock Elm Township. He married a woman named Julia, and they settled in Wisconsin. They had a couple of children, but they all died shortly after birth. They did have another child who lived for a year. But when they took him to visit relatives one winter, he was so tightly bundled that he was smothered to death. Julia Ingalls was so distraught over the deaths of her children that in 1888, she was admitted to the Wisconsin State Hospital for the Insane at Mendota. 5 years later, she was transferred to the Dunn State Asylum for the Chronic Insane in Wisconsin, and she passed away in May of 1910. So I think... I don't know. It's possible she was just like, I love Uncle George. I'm going to write him into this. And he's just call him wild. We're going to ignore all of this stuff that's going on in my family. But nonetheless, it's very tragic. I think when I was reading about this stuff, it just started making me think like, we're really talking about real people. You know, it's sometimes we forget that these are real settlers. These are real farmers. These are real people who are in these books. And although they might be more cartoony because of where they're coming from the eyes of a 5-year-old. It was such a turbulent time in the country, and infant deaths were just really everywhere. It bummed me out to find that information, but it explained a little bit about how the family dynamic was working and why she didn't bring up Hiram. Maybe there was just some type of thing. Not sure. Leaving it all open.
The descriptions of the ants with their, you know, how they just, you know, worked so hard on their appearance. And then you're thinking, or I'm thinking in my head, wow, like they just took so much pride, even though, you know, like just in getting ready and the description that Laura put. And I'm sure as a little girl, like looking up to these older ants and watching them, I would have loved that, you know. So I know that was.
I thought that that was such a sweet story.
Yeah, definitely.
I thought, like, when they were talking about the parting of the hair and getting dressed, it was very elegant. It was very, like, all of a sudden there was a Cinderella type of moment. And
right. Yeah, we went from the bugle playing uncle to, you know, and then the ants were just seemed so refined to me in the description, the way she described them and their process of getting dressed and the corsets. And, you know, that was probably Laura's first time watching someone get in a corset.
And the description of all the babies on the bed was so
funny. Babies lined up in a row.
And the two Lauras.
Oh my God, I love the two Lauras.
I know. That could be its own book, right? Laura Ingalls and Laura Ingalls.
Oh my God.
It's so exciting to find out there was another.
I have a cousin with the same exact name as me. And yeah, our cable company sometimes sends me his cable bill because our I think we have a very similar email address. And he probably wrote it down wrong once because I know I wouldn't. And I'm not a moron worked. Like that guy. And but yeah, it's kind of weird to have somebody who have the same exact name, exactly. Like even middle name, you know. But wow. But the two Lauras get into an argument. Do you guys want to talk about why they were arguing? About the
prettiest baby.
Certainly wasn't Carrie.
We don't
Carrie.
Know what the other Laura's baby's name was, though.
Mm-mm. Maybe it was Carrie.
That would sure be weird.
It's like, you guys need to get a name book.
But I loved the illustration in my edition.
Mm-hmm. Is that the swirly one where they look like cinnamon rolls?
Yeah, yes. And the two little Lauras were just...
Oh, I love it.
And the baby's all in a pile on the bed.
I also love how they're arguing, and Ma comes in, and she's like, Laura! And
they both hush. Yeah.
And they both stopped.
I loved it. It was.
You know, she did it in the mama's
so neither
home.
Laura said anything more.
Moms don't change, right? I mean, that's a moment that I think every mom in the world is like, damn right. But people start arriving. Pa gets his fiddle out because it's not a party without Pa's fiddle.
No.
And he goes, he starts singing the OU Buffalo Gals. Are you coming yes. out tonight? And I'm not going to sing it. And you know, the whole scene with Grandma and Crazy Uncle George jigging.
Loved it.
I loved yes. it. It was so colorful. It was so... Can we talk about, like, what you guys kind of thought, like, visually when you were reading this part? Like, when, you know, the music is going on, it's going crazy. If we can just go around and... I would love to just hear what everyone thinks of the room visually. Starting
well,
with
I thought, first of all,
yeah.
that Grandma and Grandpa had a pretty big house to mm-hmm. host this. That was a pretty big room
mm-hmm.
for them to host a dance.
I wasn't picturing it as a big room. I was picturing it as a little tiny room.
like guess
an elevator.
I mean, doesn't Laura say that their house was so much bigger than their own?
Did she? I might have missed
that.
She did. Yes, she said she could run from one side to the other.
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that. Okay.
Big too, yeah.
What'd you call it? Like the grand room?
The square dancing going on.
You know, the whole thing, though, I just had this whole vision of... You know, the cooking going on in the background. Also, the book is very well descriptive with, you know, there's cooking and you smell that caramelization going in the air. I picture more of a candy smell than a maple syrup smell, but it just in my head, and I just picture it being really warm. They probably have, like, fires going on in the kitchen and there's probably have a fireplace going.
And they're in wool dresses.
And they're all in there. They're all, like, in the same room. And Pa's probably just sweating through his whole shirt, you know? I picture Michael Landon doing it, of course.
Yeah.
And just...
Don't he just all. Takes his shirt off.
And everybody is just being so, I guess... it's the best version of themselves being given to people they're fully comfortable with. Like, you know, it's nobody's fighting and nobody's arguing. It's like everybody's just having this really great time. And I just picture it as being just a really wonderful experience. And I thought it was really a fun thing where they're describing how Grandma gets there and she goes and she's jigging and
and her eyes are twinkling. That's one of my favorite words when I read that, when someone describes mm-hmm. their eyes as twinkling, not like Santa, but you know, it's just, you get that. For me, I got that image of Grandma and she's just like in her element. Like she is jigging her little booty off and she, and like the people are like, you can't beat her, George. Like she was not going to fold to her
Yeah, and Laura's like, yeah. And Grandma was jinging, and it was like,
yeah, it's like she finally was able to step away from, you know, doing the graining and the boiling and the churning and the stirring. You know, it's like she got her big moment, which I thought I just loved.
I think Grandma was a little crazy, a little wild too. I think she was, seemed like a lot more fun, but maybe very strict.
I definitely imagine it's like, you know, it's a small area, so I'm sure everyone knows everyone, and they're doing this after a long winter of being cooped up inside.
That's a good point, yeah.
And if you think about it, everyone knows everyone, but everyone probably definitely has a good relationship with Grandma and Grandpa. Mm-hmm. So when Grandma comes out of the kitchen and does her thing, they're just like, yes. Entertainment. Show up your son.
Yeah. You're right. They did. We're all kind of going through that a little bit, or maybe we've gone through it.
Yes, we're like, we can finally
other people.
Right, yes. Like you get to like a family affair, and all of a sudden it's like, oh wow, we're all together, and it's not a funeral. You know, it's like, wow, we can actually have a meal together.
You know what? Those aunts were dressing up.
Yeah.
Stephanie, I think that's a good point, because I got the same feeling that Grandma and Grandpa Ingalls were like, they were the people, right? They were the everyone. That's was the connection, was them. You know, that's where everybody came to see or visit or yeah, I definitely got that feeling that they were the people, you know.
Say that about older generations, how they really are the glue of the family. And once they pass away, very often that glue is gone, and these like kind of things never happen.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Would this dance have happened if they weren't the host? You know what I mean? Like if they weren't there. Yeah.
You would hope, but
you, like you said, you don't always see that happen. So anyway,
not everyone wants to carry that legacy. Yeah.
Favorite chapters. I just loved it.
Yeah, me too.
I am definitely not a social person, but I swear I will love to have the opportunity to go to this. It just sounds wonderful.
Right? Yeah. You're going to be that glue, I think, when you're like 81. but thankfully, Grandma remembers the syrup just in time. She goes, "It's waxing, y'all." And they basically pour maple syrup on top of snow to produce a very chewy candy.
Mm. It sounds wonderful.
And they ate so much they couldn't eat anymore. Like,
oof, yeah.
What was that? That line that brown sugar never hurt anyone?
Yes.
Right. It was one of those kind of weird things. I got a flashback to just maybe a decade ago when they were saying, well, I don't give my kid high fructose corn syrup. It's like, well, why not? It's fine in moderation, you know? It's a very weird commercial. But it's it's like, hey, maple syrup never hurt nobody, but don't eat that crackling. That's far too rich for little girls.
Far too rich.
We can't have a Pudgy Mary. So, you know, it's what they want to say. I don't know. But it's just weird. Like, you know, nowadays, I'm like, well, both of those are kind of like, you know, not the best thing for you. Anyway, so everyone gets their fresh snow. We get, I find anyway, at this point where everybody's getting the snow, it returns to this description again, where all of a sudden there's a frost in the sky. There's cold on the cheeks, you know, there's fresh white snow. Everything becomes this overly descriptive moment. And it just like, it seems like it goes on, it goes off. It's almost like, so an editor went through and circled sections. Got to rewrite this one and rewrite this one, but this one's fine. I don't know. Maybe I'm just overthinking it. But yeah, maple sugar never hurt anybody. It's actually in my notes. I missed it. It was on the next page. When they'd eaten the soft maple candy until they could eat no more of it, and they helped themselves from the long table loaded with pumpkin pies and dried berry pies and cookies and cakes, there was salt-rising bread, too, and cold-boiled pork and pickles. Oh, how sour the pickles were.
So random.
Yeah. It's like, let me just get a slice of that pumpkin pie and give me some of that cold-boiled pork and a pickle.
I'll eat a pickle with anything. I really will.
You were feeling this. You're like, yes, I can.
I totally get her. Yeah.
You're saying pickles go with everything?
Pretty much.
Yeah. I make my own pickles, and I love pickles. I don't know if I could have a slice of pumpkin pie with a pickle.
Well, Well, I don't like pumpkin pie, so I couldn't go for that, but so yeah.
And you're insane. No, I'm kidding. No, I my wife hates pumpkin pie. I have to sneak it in the house during the November months. After eating the maple candy and the fiddling and the dancing resume, the rest of the syrup is grained and it's ready to pour and cool for maple sugar. Laura describes the twirling of skirts and the stomping of boots, and then she falls asleep listening to the sound of Pa's fiddle. The next morning was more food. I think they were Italian. I don't know. She describes the way the chapter ends is actually, does somebody want to read the way the chapter ends with the sun was warm? Yeah, the sun was warm.
The sun was warm and the trotting horses threw up bits of muddy snow with their hooves. Behind the sled, Laura could see their footprints, and every footprint had gone through the thin snow into mud. Before night, Pa said, we'll see the last of the sugar snow.
We get these little poems almost at the end of each chapter that don't feel like they're written by even Laura Ingalls or Rose Wilder. I'm going conspiracy theory fully here.
You've embraced it.
I just feels like it's written by several people. And I love it. I think it all works really well together. It's also possible, you know, the book was written over the course of 2 decades. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, writing progresses. But chapter 9, going to town. This one broke my heart. It broke your heart?
Well, just the way that Laura sees herself and Mary with the golden curls.
Yeah,
and
dirt brown hair.
Yeah. Well, Laura's was only dirt brown.
I know, dirt.
As spring came in the big woods, Laura and Mary would now enjoy the outdoors. This is one of those things that never would work for me, but, the whole running around barefoot all day type of thing. Oh,
I'm barefoot right now.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just not one of these people. And, but they did have to wash their feet every night. Thank God.
Thank goodness, but
they weren't, it's not like they were stepping in things that maybe we would all be stepping in or me. I don't want to say where you guys. You know, I'm on Long Island. Who knows what's in my soil? But, you know, it's you know, they didn't have oil spills and, you know, God knows what being poured into their soil. So I guess, it was really just the worst thing that you're really going to step on is, like, poop. And that you just go down to the creek.
Their feet were just so dusty that they didn't want to get the sheets all dirty.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Washing those sheets by hand was a pain in the tuchus.
Took his Yiddish. All right. So the playhouses that they had seemed very cute. Laura had hers. We only talk about how Mary could swing on Laura's tree, but we don't really hear so much about how Mary had to let Laura swing in her tree.
I think there was only one.
Yeah.
Oh, there was only one. I got this impression that there were two swings at least.
No,
it was on a low branch of Laura's tree.
Oh, okay.
But she had to share, yeah. But see, this is what we were talking about, like, or when you were saying that, and about, like, how she felt about herself. Like, here, look, she got her own swing, even if you had, you know what I mean? Like, I think she sometimes forgets how she does get a little bit of favoritism from Paul. Yeah.
Anything is going to be taken the wrong way.
Right.
If someone gets one chicken nugget more than the other, or anything is going to be taken the wrong way.
It's Laura got the swing, not Mary and her golden curls.
But I like the way they described it. I thought it was really sweet, very Alice in Wonderland-y. It reminded me of the way it was set up, reminded me of the way it was described in the upstairs in the attic of the little house. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really made do with what they had, and I really appreciate that aspect of these children. They never seem bored. That's one thing that you can, except on Sundays, they just didn't seem bored.
I was going to say, Sundays was not fun. But I mean, yes, they entertained themselves. They made, what did it say? They made little leaf cups and saucers. Yeah. They made, you know, hats out of leaves for their dolls. And, you know,
describe the leaves as juicy.
Girls being girls, yeah.
Call them juicy leaves.
Juicy leaves.
Pa came around and Pa asked, what do you think I saw today? And he said that he saw a mother doe. With her fawn. I'd love it if one of you talked about this aspect upon it. I wanted to know what your point of view is here when he's sharing these stories with his kids.
Well, I think it is. I never have gone hunting before,
mm-hmm.
but I do have my dad used to up in Michigan, but I think he's just explaining why you don't hunt at certain times, mm-hmm. or you don't kill a mother deer when you know that she has a baby.
Yeah.
And I think he's just kind of telling them little stories to keep them interested.
Yeah, I think so too. We get to see a side of Pa throughout this book where he has this true respect for animals and nature,
mm-hmm.
That I think that we all can really respect. Of course, to a point, you know, later on, he scares away a bear because he wants that honey. It's like, you had enough honey, Fetso. But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where I do get the impression that Pa's a hippie, really. But, you know, he has to feed his family at the end of the day. And we get to that. We also learn that the family would soon take a trip into the town of Pepin, which we learned in the last episode is still around. Lake Pepin, and the girls would be able to come because they're finally old enough. Even Laura,
right?
Laura, you're not going to have to
see a store before, you know.
You know, it's coming back to me now why this is a little bit tragic, because of the store owner's comment. So we'll mm-hmm. get to it. I love when they were playing with their dolls, Charlotte and Nettie. I'm like, oh, you'd like to come into the town? No, dear, no. Perhaps next year, if you're good. If you're good. It's very Harriet all of a sudden. Perhaps. But it was a big deal. They'd never gone into a town.
No, and they had to take a midweek bath. I mean that's how big of a deal it was. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's gonna throw everything off.
Everything's off. The whole week schedule's off. But yeah, I mean, that was a huge deal. And they curled their hair and they wore their best clothes, it said, you know.
It's like when you go to one of these like really big malls and you see that one person who's dressed up a little too nice for the mall.
Right.
But they got up and everybody dressed in their very best clothing. Pa got the horses and wagon ready and they started their journey into town. The ride into town, I learned, was 7 miles. Well, I started kind of averaging things, and this is all on average. If we're going to determine that a schooner or schooner, is it schooner or schooner?
Schooner.
Schooner. Mm-hmm. They go roughly 2 miles per hour. I mean, we're not, you know, this is not a Tesla. At 7 miles, we're looking at about 4 hours each way.
Wow.
In one day. I mean, let's see. During the 1870s, Pepin was home to the Ingalls family. You know, they finally moved there at some point. Their cabin lies 7 miles north of Pepin. Traveling to town was especially hard in those times, and a short trip might take you several hours or days, depending on the conditions.
Mm.
And the first railroad did not come through Pepin until 1886. Woof. So it's a big deal, clearly. As they got closer to town, Laura was amazed at how the houses were not made of logs. They were made of boards. Right. You know, we can make easy jokes at these type of things, right? But, you know, Laura is 5, 6 years old. She's a baby, basically. Her house was simple, and these are much more complicated looking, and they're just different. And she'd never seen it. It's like a total modern type of situation.
Her world is like super small at this point because she's probably only met her relatives and the people like at this dance that was before. Mm-hmm. I mean, she even says that even though it wasn't a Monday, some woman had done her wash that day.
Right.
And like she thinks that every woman in the world washes on Mondays.
Right.
Because that's how her mother does it.
It's what Ma does, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful point. That's wow. But she was amazed that the houses were also really close together. They weren't just like, you know, acres and acres apart. And she also saw kids just playing in Pepin, and Pa said, "That's Pepin." Whatever that means. Like, I picture Albert Ingalls running around. "Hey guys, I'm gonna go sleep. You take a nap under the
under the tree."
No, the staircase. So the family went into the store so Pa could trade his furs for goods at the store. This, you know, another thing that's interesting is that Pa, he traded furs. And we mentioned this last time that he wasn't so much of a farmer in this, but we do see that he really was a farmer. He was making money 24/7. Every day, every month out of the year, he was generating money or goods to trade for his family. He's a hard worker. You couldn't just be a farmer. You also had to, you know, be a furrier or of some sort. Not a furrier, but somebody who traded furs. The creepo storekeeper knew Pa, and everybody was like, "Oh my goodness, he knows that's Nels," you know. But it wasn't Nels. It was another. It was a creepo storekeeper, and does anybody want to see the quote that he said? I just can't even throw up in my mouth.
The storekeeper said to Pa and Ma, "That's a pretty little girl you've got there," and he admired Mary's golden curls. But he did not say anything about Laura or about her curls. They were ugly and brown.
Can I just say, what a dick?
I mean, so rude. That. Don't say that. Yeah. You say pretty girls.
Oh, my yes. God. Unless you're a creepo. You know what I mean? Like, hey, you got a fine-looking woman there, Chuck. Chaz.
The fine-looking woman.
Chaz. They're best friends now. He, you know, Charles has spent quite. He's drank with this guy. Chess. Oh. What happens in Pepin stays in Pepin.
They have a bumper sticker, I think, on their back.
I think I just wrote a new Warner Grove cast sticker.
There you go. Yes.
So. But the store seemed immense, right? I mean, they were talking about there's machinery and
all the fabrics, like all of the different colors and every color and
calicos. I learned that calicos are basically very simple materials, that they're like kind of unbleached.
Kind of like homespun.
Yeah, but Ma still picked out ones that had very nice patterns, but they had store-bought sugar. I do have some prices I want to just throw out there. Flour was about $5.50 for 100 pounds. Sugar was 25 cents a pound, same price as coffee. Black calico was 10 cents a yard. Pink calico was also 10 cents a yard. A wool hat was $1. A Stetson, like a branded hat, was $4.50. I mean, that's worth well over $100 in today's money. It's fancy. And I do have a picture of what this store might have looked like. And it's not as glamorous, of course, as what's in our minds. You know, it's a really impressive description of all of the stuff that they have in there. Mary and Laura were both given a candy heart, thankfully. I don't know why they couldn't give one to Carrie. Carrie's like a baby. But
she's a baby.
Yeah, but
she's a baby.
You can see, look at this, a little something, I don't know. But yeah. Sweets to the sweet, we heard. After they were done at the store, the family went to the lakeshore for a picnic. For dinner, there was bread and butter and cheese, hard-boiled eggs and cookies. I was like, all right.
Yeah, I could do that.
You know what? That's not a bad, you know what? It's not the best. It's not the fried chicken they had at the Brady Bunch picnic. But sandwiches. It'll do. Yeah,
bread. Can I ask, did anybody else picture the mercantile from the show when they were reading this chapter?
I didn't, actually.
It's like a Mass General store. Like we have a few around here. That's what I was picturing.
Gotcha. When I was reading this, I was just in Lancaster last week, and I was in an antique store that was kind of like a three-floor type of monstrosity of a building, and I found absolutely nothing of value to me. I found a lot of things of value, but apparently it all costs three times what I think it's worth. That's what I pictured. You know, it was like this big, you know, that's what the guy had, so much stuff like this. And I kind of pictured a lot of chaos, like a big chaos, being afraid I'm going to bump into stuff. Yeah, just too much stuff.
There's not a garden center and housewares. It's just higgledy-piggledy.
Yeah, there's no guy who's wearing like a golf shirt that says, you know, Lowe's on it or anything. Where's the tiles?
Plumbing, please.
Plumbing, please. Oh, those guys are always grumpy. Pa went back to the store to speak to the men while after everybody was hanging out at the lake, which I thought was kind of interesting. It's kind of like, I'm going to go back. I go talk to the guys, you know, which is pretty nice. You know, I think we all kind of went through that as well. You know, you get around adults and it's like, it's a little bit of a social craziness going on. You're so excited to have a real adult conversation with real adults after the pandemic. Pa went back to speak to the men. Laura and Mary explored the lake. I really love the scene where they picked up smooth stones. if one of you guys want to talk about how Laura picked up the stones, and I just thought it was so sweet, and I could see myself doing this. It's such a boy thing, really.
She just kept picking up stones. She found a pretty one. Laura would put it in her pocket, and there were so many, each prettier than the last, that she filled her pocket full. Then Pa called, and they all ran back to the wagon, for the horses were hitched up, and it was time to go. So then he lifted her over into the wagon, and her pocket fell off.
Oh, my God.
And she was sad because she had ruined her best dress. And then they started telling her that she was, stop crying, Laura. I can fix it. And next time, don't be so greedy.
I didn't take it like that. I thought it was like one of those things where they thought, like, aw, like she was just trying to have fun and she just ripped the pocket. You know, Ma shows her that it's really just a pocket that's sewn with really cheap thread to her dress.
And I'm impressed that pockets were in a dress anyway. I mean, ladies, you know how hard that is to find a dress with pockets.
Right. Should be a rule.
Well, but she did tell her another time, don't be so greedy.
I thought it was lighthearted, but she probably meant it seriously as well. And Wednesday's coming and we can mend it.
Yes.
In my pile of mending things. But and Pa left. So I thought that maybe that's why I thought it was all okay, you know. But Mary was always perfect. She was always good and sweet. And I'm like, oh, I'm just over here. I have one. I kept one little stone.
My very golden curls.
It's my memory stone. My Pa.
And she had a heart with a poem on it.
Oh, brother.
Laura didn't have a poem on her heart. So but... I think Laura's starting to get a little bit sick of Mary.
Right.
Yeah.
We're getting to like the, you know, the Marsha moments, you know.
Yes.
The sun was going down, but they felt safe with Pa and his gun. They were just kind of, I thought this was a nice description as they're heading home. And although it was getting darker and darker, but it was time for them to go home, and Pa sang songs the whole way home. And I don't know this song, but I do have a link to a YouTube link of somebody singing it. Mid pleasures and palaces, though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. I do know that song. I thought it was something else. Chapter 10, Summertime. Summertime in the big woods was a time for visiting. And Laura and Mary would visit Mrs. Peterson, who always gave them cookies, and the Ingalls always had people visiting them as well. This is what I thought was kind of interesting, is that Mrs. Peterson was Swedish, and they would teach each other English and Swedish. I thought that was a really interesting dynamic. I don't picture that in the Little House in the Prairie universe, unless we're talking about, like, Lars.
Right.
Lars
Hansen. Right.
They would receive cookies from Mrs. Peterson. And for some reason, Mrs. Peterson was really tight with the cookies. She wouldn't say, here, give one to Carrie.
Right. I had the same thought, Mark. I was like, why don't you just give her three?
Maybe she just didn't think about it.
Right.
Maybe she didn't know baby Carrie existed.
Yeah. I mean, she's Swedish, right? I mean, she couldn't understand. They could have just cut it into thirds, by the way.
This would have been a good math lesson for the girls. Right.
Yeah, I
thought Ma was a teacher.
Yeah.
You thought
a
wrong.
A fashionable teacher, apparently.
Clearly, she can only count up to two. So they would each eat half the cookie, and they would save their other half for Carrie, who would get, when you add it together, a whole.
Or Carrie wasn't even there. She don't know what she's missing. Just eat the cookie.
I'm just surprised they didn't split it again in half. Who knows what these kids are doing?
Why does Carrie need a whole cookie? She doesn't have any teeth.
Maybe they weren't very good. Actually, what am I talking about? They were probably delicious. They were probably those delicious Swedish butter cookies. Exactly. Swedish butter is no joke. It's some of the best. We also have neighbors such as Mr. and Mrs. Huleit, who would come over, and they brought their children, Eva and Clarence, with them. And Laura liked to play with Clarence the most.
Of course.
Well, you know, rough and tumble. Mm-hmm. On one particular day, their Aunt Lottie was coming to visit, and the girls wanted to see whose hair she liked the best. Who wants
to
talk
about
this?
Wait, we need to go back and talk about Clarence's suit.
Clarence's outfit! Yeah.
Right. You know what? You guys talk, if you could.
It had bright gilt buttons and trimmed braid, and he had copper-toed shoes.
Yes. He was fancy.
Clarence was supremely fancy.
Well, with a name like Clarence in the little in the big woods, you have to be a little fancy.
I did not look up copper-toed shoes. Did anyone?
No, I may have
that later. I'm intrigued.
Little girls did wear copper toes.
Right. Yeah, they did say that. Anyway.
And Mary and Eva walked nicely and talked.
Let's see. So Aunt Lottie was coming to visit, and the girls wanted to see whose hair they liked the best. JJ, do you want to talk about the golden curls versus brown curls gate?
Yeah.
Ma knew what she was doing, by the way.
She did.
She absolutely did. She knew that her feelings had been hurt, and she wanted to see, you know, get that in. And of course, sweet Aunt Lottie says, I like both kinds best. So but Laura was like miserable. It said that she was, you know, she didn't want to hear because she knew that it was going to be golden curls. So I love that moment where she said, I like both kinds best. And then took them each one by the hand, one on either side, and danced along to the door where Ma stood.
I think that's a perfect answer.
Really nice. Yes.
It's a perfect answer. Mm-hmm. We also get, we're back to the overly descriptive part of the book. The sunshine came streaming through the windows into the house, and everything is so neat and pretty. The table was covered with a red cloth, and the cooked stove was polished shiny black. Through the bedroom door, Laura could see the trundle bed in its place under the big bed. The pantry door stood wide open, giving the sight and smell of goodies on the shelves. And Black Susan came purring down the stairs from the attic where she had been taking a nap. I love that. I thought there was... Mm-hmm. I love the way it's written. It's almost musical, I think. Not the way I read it, with the screaming through the windows. But I do love it. I think that there's a certain tonality to it when you're reading it. Let's see. On this particular day, the girls were picking up chips for the fire, and Mary told Laura that Aunt Lottie liked her hair better. And do you guys want to talk about what Laura did?
Woo, she got all of her frustration out and slapped her.
I think she had it coming.
Slap her around the big woods.
She smacked her good. Right across the face.
She knew what she was saying. She was nasty.
Pa was not happy, though, and Laura got a strapped. A strap? Got strapped, right?
Yeah.
So she got
whipped with a strap.
But when you got hit with a strap, is it called being strapped, I wonder?
I've heard it called that.
But she got hit, and she cried, of course. Pa hugged her that night. She's asking him if he prefers gold or brown curls. I mean, she's really upset about this. She thinks she's ugly, you know? It's just so, like, especially, I think, for a little girl, and you have this one sister with the blonde hair, and your hair is, like, you're being told it's dirt brown. The competition, it's a tough one when you have to, like, you know, see her every day. Mary.
She's perfect. Yes. I mean, that's how Laura sees her. She would never say the things or do the things that Laura would, you know, and I just think that, if Mary would ever, you know, let down her golden hair and just let loose one time, but she doesn't do that. And Laura just, you know, feels inferior, I guess.
If Laura had only watched the episodes when Mary loses her vision and see what happens to her hair.
That's a TV
reference.
With that bad grown-up wig that she wears.
Oof.
Yes.
But Pa says the best thing in the world. He says, well, I have brown hair, half pint. And she's like, you know what? You're right. And it's like, who's Mary's pa? No, so that wasn't said.
It's a milkman.
Uncle George.
And that's where I went deep diving. No, I didn't deep dive. And I found Hiram. No, that's all jokes, people. It's all jokes. So as the summer wore on, the Ingalls were very busy. Pa worked in the fields all day, and Ma and the girls weeded the garden, fed the animals. And another thing they did was make cheese, which we all love. Oh, I love cheese.
The greatest food group ever.
I don't think I'm going to eat it after this, though.
Ugh. But Rennet. Let's Rennet. This next chapter is called Rennet.
Yeah.
So,
or ruin it.
Ruin it. Yeah, good point. So Rennet, I guess we'll just talk a little bit about it. The bottom line is I knew this a little bit, but I didn't know this much about it. Now I know too much about it, and I bet you guys do too. So yes. Rennet is needed to make cheese because what it does is it is an enzyme that exists in the fourth stomach of a calf who is still getting its mother's milk. It's never eaten solid food. So it's like a cute little calf, and what you must do is slaughter it and make lamb chops, take its stomach, you remove the inner lining, which has those enzymes. And when that makes contact with the milk, it curdles it and allows it to you to make cheese because of the enzymes that exist in it. Nowadays, they still do this in the same manner, but there are other ways of making cheese. So thank you don't goodness. Have to have rennet, but most good cheeses will be made with rennet, just the way it is.
What accident did occur for this to act like, oh, this is how you make cheese.
This is how we make cheese.
I was just playing with a calf's stomach.
Well, actually, I have an answer to that.
Okay.
According to history/legend, a traveling Arabic merchant had brought some milk along with his journeys. The pouch in which he placed the milk in was lined with the stomach of a sheep. As he traveled, the heat from the sun activated the enzyme, the rennet, and it just kind of coagulated in the bag. This made the milk turn into its liquid whey. Solid curd or cheese components, and thus cheese was revealed. And then cheese migrated to America by way of the Mayflower and became a staple in the U.S. The process has had many developments throughout history. Nowadays, instead of using the enzyme rennet, a synthetic chymotrypsin, whatever derivative, is sometimes used along with extracts from mold and plants. Is the moon really made of green cheese?
Why, yes, it is.
Well, Laura asked and Ma laughed. I think people say that because it looks like a green cheese, but appearances are deceiving. And she wiped all the green cheeses and rubbed them all with butter, maybe some of that Swedish butter, and she told them about the dead cold moon and that it is like a little world in which nothing grows, which I just think...
How does she know?
She's right. I just thought it was really interesting that people even had an opinion about the moon. I always wonder about that. What was the actual general consensus of what is on the moon? And, and Ma was like, nothing's up there. Look at it. It's like green cheese.
Well, it's the only thing on TV at night in their world, so they just stare at the moon and make assumptions, yeah. I guess.
It's true. We also get another song about Old Grimes, which I thought was a really fun song, where, again, the words are changed, and I'll put a link to the actual one about Old Grimes, who's dead. Pa's always telling these great stories through music, which I think is really fun. But Old Grimes had a wife who Pa claimed was a mean, tight-fisted woman. According to the story, if she had not skimmed all the milk, a little cream would have run off into the whey, and Old Grimes might have staggered along. But she skimmed every bit of the cream, and poor Old Grimes got so thin, the wind blew him away, plum starved to death.
Then Pa looked at Ma and said, nobody could starve to death where you're around, Caroline. Well, no, Ma said. No, Charles, not if you are there to provide for us.
I can hear the popcorn popping.
Yes, popcorn.
Yeah. Love
Jeez.
It.
Pa was room. Pleased, and it was all so pleasant.
Room. Oh, wait, we all share one.
Yeah. Turn the other way, girls. All right. But one afternoon, Pa was, hey, you guys have dirty minds. I was just a bunch of creepers.
I said nothing.
One afternoon, Pa was on his way to Uncle Henry's when he discovered a bee tree. He chopped down the tree and cleared it out of the honey, and the family would have honey for the whole winter. Now, this was a pretty exciting scene, I thought.
I didn't understand. I mean, I get it because he said he wasn't hunting and it's summer, but he still didn't take his gun. And I thought at the beginning of the book, it was like he always took his gun when he went, you know. But anyway. But
well, that was Grandpa.
That was Grandpa. But you thought it would have passed down.
Exactly.
But you know,
but it says that he looked around, you know, and he saw this big bear standing at the foot of a tree and bees were buzzing around him. And he made a great racket banging the club against a tree and the bear just waddled off. I mean, that's bravery. I wouldn't do that.
But you know, he did say how bears are more friendly. I forget the line. I wish I clipped it. He refers to the bears and the panthers as more friendly.
They're so they're fat and this time of year that they're lazy and good-natured.
Good-natured.
I still wouldn't be like, are you a good-natured bear? I don't know.
I would say you're a fool, Ingalls.
Here, you take the rest of the honey.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of weird, but he comes across the bear who's just kind of scooping out the honey and eating it, and the bees are all trying to sting the bear, but because his fur is so thick and everything, he's just like, whatever. Pa just makes a racket, scares him off. It's funny, too. The way it's described is kind of like he didn't have to do much. The bear is just like, darn, I'm just going to get out of here now. My big sticky paw. Yeah, Pa comes back. He collects all of the wash bins and all of everything. He just collects all of these pans and pots. When he comes back, he says, Caroline, can you grab this bucket of honey? It was so, I thought, cute, but nice little ribbing where Caroline was disappointed because she thought it was just one bucket of honey. It's like, oh, well, even one bucket's something, Charles. Disappointing. No popcorn for you tonight. And takes it, and she notices in the back of the wagon that all of the containers are just dripping with honey. Tons of honey.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I mean, it's too much sugar. I mean, it's too many sweets, to my opinion. They have all this maple. They have all this. The cup runneth over. But yeah, I thought that was a really sweet thing. Now, we get into more of Pa being a farmer in Chapter 11. Oddly enough, Harvest. Chapter 11, right? in the Ingalls' life, Chapter 11. So, so Laura,
lose this one.
Yeah, Pa and Uncle Henry are working to harvest. They're trying to harvest oats before the rain comes, and Ma and Aunt Polly are at the house preparing supper. Again, we talk about supper. The children are in the yard playing. At lunch, Pa and Uncle Henry return home to eat, and when they return back to the field, they take the oldest child, Charlie. So, does anybody want to talk about Charlie? Charlie seems kind of like a cool kid. He knows how to jump stumps.
He seems like a Willie Olson.
Yeah.
Yes. That's exactly.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Kind of picture the big wild hair. I thought it was really funny.
So Charlie, I guess, was spoiled and never had to do any hard work like Charles.
Mm-hmm.
When Charles was 11, he was driving the team, but they took Charlie out there and he didn't want to be out there. He wanted to keep playing, so he started playing the game like the boy who called wolf.
Yeah, the boy who cried wolf.
And Pa and Uncle Henry would go and try to save him, and he'd laugh and say, gotcha. And then he stepped on a beehive.
Well, you know, he does this three times, though. He pranks them three times. But he also got in their way. He hides the whetstone. He doesn't bring them water. He just followed them and asked it like a million questions, probably about Minecraft or something. And he just started screaming. And yeah, Pa came out and Pa was just like, oh, this kid. It's like, I'm so glad I didn't have a boy.
There's a certain level of obedience that in this time era, mm-hmm. but he's a brat in this time too. Like in our current time, like, this
oh, 100%.
Right.
But don't you think that it would have been in Pa's place to put him in this place? Or no?
I don't think so.
For 1870s.
I mean, I don't think so.
Oh, yeah. I think
when it's someone else's kid.
No, but I think your uncles nephew. Have a different... I do think uncles
Yeah. As an uncle, I put my fair share of nephews and nieces in their place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my aunt's... their parent?
Oh, yeah. It was everybody raising everybody else's kid.
Yeah.
To a point. You know, I'm just saying, it's one of those things where sometimes you just have to do a correction, I guess. I'm not saying, you know, discipline. I'm not saying, you know, do anything that is over the line, but saying something. I don't know. Uncle Henry seemed to be a bit of a pushover because Charlie just laughed. So that whole thing kind of rubbed me wrong. But a fourth time, Charlie just kept screaming. And was it Charles who said, just let him? No, I think it was Uncle Henry who said,
scream.
Just let him scream. Not Meanwhile, he's dead.
He didn't die.
No, he didn't die. He's going to wish he did after this mummy rap that we're about to talk about. So they go, maybe something's wrong, you know, like, hey, he's not stopping with the screaming and it's getting worse. So they go over to him. I feel bad for Charlie, to be honest with you, but he was a little bit of a jerk, you know, for doing all this, but it really was a boy who cried wolf story. He got stung. He got stung by all the yellow jackets, and yellow jackets are some of the worst because they get sting over and over again.
So bad.
Yeah, and it said they were in his nose, you know, in his neck, in his pants leg, crawling down his shirt. Like, oh, it sounds horrible.
I mean, I've been stung by a yellow jacket like once. And it was terrible. But over and over again, he's lucky he wasn't allergic. I think that's the thing with yellow jackets. Died.
Well, and I loved how they undressed him and shook everything out, and then they just sent him to the house. They didn't even walk him to the house. They just said, it's over there. I know you can't see, but...
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was like, whoa. The description of how they helped him. They got a pan of mud, and they covered him completely with the mud, and they wrapped him in a sheet. Only the mouth and nose showed through the mud and sheet. Crazy. And then Pa's like, I gotta go. I gotta milk my cow.
That illustration of him is just kind of hilarious. Yeah. I mean,
it's like it's quarter after six. Yes. It's quarter after six. I gotta milk my cow or if I want to get a whole gallon. But yeah, I mean, Laura and Mary learn of the story and they're horrified. Charlie was bad, but Pa makes that one comment, says, serve the little liar right. That's a tough one. It's a tough thing to say in front of the cousins.
I kind of feel like Pa not having a son would be like, you know, I would raise my boy better than that. Kind of, right. I would imagine that kind of banter in between him and Caroline happened a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet you're right. And that's basically...
I mean, he didn't deserve to be... I mean, the mummy rap, I mean, like, bless him. I mean, he should have gotten a spanking or something or a strapping, but not a, oh my gosh, that was horrible.
Yeah.
It's like a worst nightmare.
It really
and
is.
Charles was just like, he serves him right. And I'm just like, what, Pa?
And then, showed more compassion to the deer and the doe.
I know, right?
I didn't understand it when Laura said that she didn't understand why Pa said that, because why did he lie? I mean, he didn't lie. I was just like, did Laura listen to the whole story? Like,
exactly.
Right.
I didn't get that part. I didn't really, maybe I'm overthinking it or something. But anyway, we move on to chapter 12. The wonderful machine. Technology comes to town. It's really interesting. I found this really great photo, and I think they even talk about it in the book about horsepower. And we
They do.
It's cute. It's a nice, I think it's a nice introduction to the period of before the Industrial Revolution, I guess. But it starts out with Ma using the heads of oats to tie braids and make hats for the family, which I just think is really sweet. You talk about collecting
hats.
Ma was talented.
Oh my
Seriously.
God, she could crochet and knit
Everything.
And make butter
Everything.
And cheese, and like I said, like it was like a factory going on in that house,
right?
It was a sweatshop.
I was like, she can make hats. Like, I was just like, oh my God.
What else can you make? You can make underoos.
She did, she made underwear,
underwear. She
got
that.
I think they call bloomers ladies, but they collected hickory, hazelnuts, Hickory nuts, hazelnuts, walnuts. I used to have a walnut tree on my property. It's weird. Have you guys ever seen a walnut when it falls off the tree?
Mm-hmm. We had one growing up, too.
It smells like lime. To me, yeah. It smells like lime. And when Laura's talking about it, she's saying that the brown stains her hands. So it was kind of interesting. Those things hurt, too, if they hit you.
They hit you. Right.
Those things. I used to hate them. Ugh. We get a great description about making hulled corn. Have you guys ever eaten hulled corn?
I don't think I have.
Or hominy. Me either. But I want to. Now I really want to try it. I looked into it, and essentially we're getting this description of Ma taking corn, dried corn, and processing in the way. But she was soaking it actually in a lye solution to loosen the hard outer covering. And you would just create friction, and eventually you would be left with just the inside part that would normally pop with popcorn. You know, that's it. You would just rinse it, and you'd be able to cook with it. And it's a really boring dish, supposedly, if you just served it plain. It probably tastes a lot like popcorn without, like, the corn taste, because the kernels, I think, have a lot of flavor to them, maybe. Mm-hmm. But now that I look at them, they almost look like squeakers, you know, like that kind of cheese. They talk about squeakers too a little bit, but when you make cheese and you have the curds,
right,
they kind of look curds. Like that. They look a bit like that. So I really want to try them just out of curiosity, but you could serve them with maple syrup or Ma sometimes fries them in pork drippings, but Laura likes them with milk. Maybe it was like a cereal. I must know. So we get the 8-horsepower machine. Technology really does come. Laura watches the men bring in this large machine, which will be used to separate the wheat from the straw. And Pa's all about progress. You know, he's really ready for the Industrial Revolution. Do you guys want to talk about that? I don't really have too much to add to that. I think it's really just a lot of, like, wow, this is really great. It saves us so much time. I think it would take them weeks normally to process all of that wheat.
Do you think he had to pay like a fee or yes. like partial of his? Yeah. Okay.
Oh,
yeah,
you know what? I bet you it was a percentage.
Percentage of the wheat. Yeah.
The wheat. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It said that somewhere. Yeah.
I posted a YouTube video of somebody using one that's similar, except the horses were on a treadmill, and it is really loud. It's like, you know, you can imagine. It's just basically wood against wood and metal against metal. It's like there's nothing to kind of cushion the sound.
He says they never had heard such a racket.
Yeah, they never heard machinery, if you really think about it. I mean, wheels are about it. I mean, or a gun being fired.
Well, but I like how they ended the paragraph, you know, with Laura talking about how she was proud of Pa because he's the one that had kind of organized getting the machinery together. Like, he was too tired that night to talk to Laura, but Laura was proud of him. It was Pa who had got the other men to stack their wheat together and send away for the threshing machine, and it was a wonderful machine. Everybody was glad it had come.
Pa was all about the, you know, progress, like I said before. Mm-hmm. He dumbfounded. He's like, I saved so much time. And I think Pa was also very proud. A lot of farmers might not have embraced that type of technology. So I thought that was really great.
People respected him, obviously, in his opinions, you know, if they were to throw in with this, you know.
Yeah, people did. I think people did really respect him. I think you're right. And I think maybe Michael Landon really did hit the nail on the head when he was trying to emulate that type of character that people just look up to in the town, really. I mean, there was such a perfect balance of that character on the TV show.
That yes.
I think maybe that's something that truly does resonate with the actual person. I mean, nobody's perfect, of course, except for Michael Landon, of course.
I got that feeling. Yeah, like when I was reading this, I was thinking about, like, those episodes where Pa, you know, was getting the Grange meetings and, you know, and people are all yelling that they listen to him, right? You know, mm-hmm. And so when I was reading this, I was like, oh, that, you know, that's it does go along with that. Like, he's the one that, you know, got everyone to agree to something that was a scary step, or it might have, you know, not gone right or something, but it did, and off they went, you know. So,
or when he turns on the white man, you know, when he's standing with the Sioux Indians and he points his gun at the white man. Like that we're going to write songs about you, Michael Landon, or Charles Ingalls.
Chaz Ingalls.
Pepin. Oh. Pepin's a crazy time. So, chapter 13. It's our final chapter. The Deer in the Wood. Winter is again approaching. Winter is just kind of coming. It's getting colder. And Pa is setting out to go hunt for deer. They say that the family had not had any fresh meat since spring. They had a lot of meat, though.
But they had a lot. Yeah.
I mean, it's...
A lot.
Oof. Like, we have one of these, like, little freezers. You know, I don't know if you guys have a deep freezer. And I'm like, you know what? I mean, if there's another pandemic shutdown or something, I'm like, we'll be all right. We'll be okay.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, all right, they didn't obviously have a freezer, but... Something. I wonder, you know, that's another thing I have to wonder, you know, I guess salted meats can really kind of get a bit tiring.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, that was it. They didn't have fresh meat.
Yeah. It would be nice to, you know, get a nice old, I don't know, what I mean, lamb chop, right? I'll never look at lamb chops the same. Poor little lamb. I'll never eat another lamb chop.
Well, and I didn't really remember this from reading this when I was younger, but I mean, it really is just what a year in the life from winter to winter, you know, mm-hmm. and going through each of the seasons. It's just, you know, tidy like that, how they did that.
Yeah. And they're like, you know, Mary and Laura are both, making their quilts, you know, everything is kind of going mm-hmm. in this like kind of circle. It's
circle,
like,
right.
We're back to doing this and it's sweet. Right. It's nice.
Yeah,
I think it's a simple, like really wonderful story. That a lot of people can say, oh, we're at it again. But it's not like that, you know, because each year Mary gets better and prettier.
And prettier.
And prettier.
And her golden hair just gets more golden. So pretty. So.
But it is. It's just very sweet how they laid that out. I just love that. Because I feel like you could just read it again. Like, well, what's the next year, you know?
Maybe that was the whole point, because it was just... It really felt like the story was just beginning at that point.
Right.
As an adult, we're like, all right, well, this book is like two chapters, really.
Right.
I mean, we're really dissecting this. But I don't know. As a kid, I don't remember it being so cylindrical. But at the same time, it's really nice. I really like that whole concept. And I think it's also a trend that we see in modern writers using in books for youth, because it's always, you know, school year begins and then the end of the book is the beginning of the next school year or something along those lines.
Good point.
It's kind of like a year in the life of. So I thought it was really sweet. Pa makes a deer lick, which is essentially salt. I guess deers are attracted to salt. And he is salt. We know they have a lot of salt. So he's overlooking the salt lake. This is where Pa's kind of like a hippie. You know, he's he's just hanging out there and he sees the deer coming. And I don't know. He just cannot bring himself to mess with the beauty of nature. He's just enjoying watching. This bear comes. He's kind of gets lost in the moment. It's like this is like TV or something for him. It's like the Nature Channel. I don't know. I felt like it was a nice spiritual moment, maybe, that he had this kind of connection where some people might even say that there's an ego thing there, where it's like, you know, playing God, where he's like, I could take your life any moment. But it wasn't like that to me.
And I think that he just fell asleep and didn't get anything. And
with a loaded gun in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, and then I remembered my children. Said I need to feed them.
I'm just going to read some of this. It's a little bit long, but I think it's worth it. Now I'll tell you why you had no fresh meat to eat today. When I went to the deer lick, I climbed up into a big oak tree. I found a place on a branch where I was comfortable, and I would watch the deer lick. I was near enough to shoot any animal that came to it, and my gun was loaded and ready on my knee. There I sat and waited for the moon to rise and light the clearing. I was a little tired from chopping wood all day yesterday, complainer, and I must have fallen asleep, for I found myself opening my eyes. For one thing, maybe don't fall asleep in a tree.
With a loaded gun.
With a loaded gun. Thank you. I didn't even think of that. Yes, with a loaded gun. The big round moon was just rising. I could see it between the bare branches of the trees, light in the sky, and right against it, I saw a deer standing.
His head was up, and he was listening. His great branching horns stood out above his head. He was dark against the moon. It was a perfect shot, but he was so beautiful, and he looked so strong and free and wild that I couldn't kill him. I sat there and looked at him until he bounded away into the dark wood. Then I remembered that Ma and my little girls were waiting for me to bring home some good fresh venison, and I made up my mind that the next time I would shoot. Mm-hmm. And here's another bear, man. Paw yeah. just gets bears. After a while, a big bear came lumbering out into the open. He was so fat from feasting on berries and roots and grubs all summer that he was nearly as large as two bears.
Sure.
His head swayed from side to side.
I know hunters.
It was just a stump. Yeah. His head swayed from side to side as he went on all fours across the clear space into the moonlight until he came upon a rotten log. He smelled it and listened, and he pawed it apart and sniffed among the broken pieces, eating up fat white grubs.
So he's really just kind of watching this, you know, kind of happen. And maybe you're not giving these kind of opportunities very often to just...
National Geographic.
Yeah, to sit there and watch how it all kind of works. I thought it was really sweet. You know, he finally says that after a long while, a doe and her yearling fawn came stepping daintily out into the shadows. They were not afraid at all. They walked over to the place where I had sprinkled the salt, and they both licked up a little of it. Then they raised their heads and looked at each other. The fawn stepped over and stood beside the doe. They stood there together, looking at the woods in the moonlight. Their large eyes were shining and soft. I just sat there looking at them until they walked away among the shadows. Then I climbed down out of the tree and came home. Laura whispered in his ear, "I'm glad you didn't shoot them." Mary said, "We can eat bread and butter." And Pa lifted Mary up out of her chair and hugged them both together. "You're my good girls," he said. "And now it's bedtime. Run along while I get my fiddle." Caroline, make popcorn. So, yeah, I mean, I just thought it was so sweet. And I really love the way really this did. Entire book ends. And even the part that I just read is one way. And then the next little passage, if anybody else wants to read it, feels like it's totally written by somebody else.
But Laura lay awake in a little while, listening to Pa's fiddle softly playing and to the lonely sound of the wind in the big woods. She looked at Pa sitting on the bench by the hearth, the firelight gleaming on his brown hair and beard, glistening in the honey brown fiddle. She looked at Ma, gently rocking and knitting. She thought to herself, "This is now." She was glad that the cozy house, Pa and Ma, and the firelight and the music were now. They could not be forgotten, she thought, because now is now, and it can never be a long time ago.
I just thought it was cryptic, but it also is such a sweet way to end this book.
It's a love story to her parents.
Oh, there's no doubt about
sure
it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just a love story, yes.
I think it's a love story to the merchant owner.
Bring it back, Mark.
He's my favorite character. No, it really is. I think it's mostly a love story to Pa, but really to the entire family dynamic, but also Ma. I mean, there's so much respect and love between the people in this family, and there's that normal level of jealousy that siblings have. It's very honest in that sense.
Mm-hmm. You definitely tell that she, at this age, like she definitely wanted to carry this, because I think when she read the created this book, right, she didn't have intentions to do others.
She didn't.
So it's kind of like, this is kind of how my parents and their stories will live on. This is my dedication to my father, who does everything, my mother, who did everything, and this is how they made us cozy and warm, you know, this time in my life.
I love this story. This is the first time I ever read it slowly. Right. And I have like a different kind of appreciation for it when you do it that way. I have to thank all of you for putting the time into this, the hours. Again, we have Annie Quinn, we have Gigi Hurley, Stephanie Bailey. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you.
We had a few bumps and everything, but all in all, I had such a good time doing this.
Me too. Yeah. I loved rereading it. Like you said, a deep dive and really paying attention and feeling those words and putting yourself there. It was great.
And
so
everyone
listening should read this book.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. You can go to any local Goodwill and find these for a quarter.
Yes.
Or you go to your library, you get it for free, already paying for it in taxes. Either that or just order it on Amazon. It's probably $3, $4.
Yeah, I have a couple copies of this book for some reason. It's because I pick up yard sales. I'm like, 50 cents. Let me just grab another copy of this.
Right. It's, it's a catcher in the rye. Yeah. But, it is. It's such it's a great book to have. It's also probably a great book to give away. Thank you guys so much. I do appreciate it. This is the first episode of the Little House Book Club. Thank you for listening to the Little House Book Club. If you enjoy Little House on the Prairie and the history that surrounds it, you might want to take a listen to Wanak Grovecast as well as the Bonnet Heads podcast. All of my podcasts are family friendly and listener supported.